Welcome to the Italian Wine Podcast. I'm Rebecca Lawrence and this is Voices. In this set of interviews, I will be focusing on issues of inclusion, diversity and allyship through intimate conversations with wine industry professionals from all over the globe. If you enjoy listening, please consider donating through italianwinepodcast.com. Any amount helps us cover equipment, production and publication costs, and remember to subscribe and rate our show wherever you tune in. Welcome to the Italian Wine Podcast with me, Rebecca Lawrence. I'm pleased to be in conversation today with Stephanie Biondi, who's joining us from Etna in Sicily. Welcome to the podcast, Stephanie, and thank you so much for taking the time to have a conversation with me today. I was hoping you could introduce yourself to our listeners and maybe tell them a little bit about what you do.
Okay, right. Well, I'm British, as you can hear, but I've been living in Sicily since 91. Met Ciro towards the end of the 90s, and his family have had these vineyards on the foothills of Mount Etna, planted on craters, but they'd virtually been abandoned. So we decided to take it upon ourselves to sort of like this legacy that had been left to him. We decided we needed to replant, really, because it saddened us to see this, these craters with, crumbling terraces with very few vines left, whose Ciro's father was actually making wine from the vines. But just selling it on Sunday mornings, selling it sfuso. Ciro's actually grandfather and great uncle. They were actually producing wine at the turn of the century and winning prizes at Lyon and Paris. But then that all went into decline after the Second World War. But Ciro's father, he continued making wine, but we realised that, the wine he was making was fairly done in a very artisan way. And we felt we could, try and sort of improve on that. But the main objective, as I said, was to replant the vineyards because they were so beautiful. And so obviously it was the vineyards were in their full sort of, they were producing at their full potential then, but so being abandoned after the Second World War, and this is when we decided to start and embark on this adventure to restore the vineyards, making a little bit of wine along the way in order to pay for the planting and the restoration of the vineyards, let's say. So now here we are a little bit further along the line. We started off with producing about 5,000 bottles in 99, and now we're producing about 250,000 and with about 7 hectares. So it's just been, increasing the production slowly, slowly along the way, restoring the vineyards, increasing the production until where we've got today. So that's really a little bit of the background, what we're doing now.
So, of course, I also have to ask you to rewind a little bit more, because obviously, as you said, you're British, but now living in Italy. But I understand you also spent your childhood in Nigeria. So before we do a bit more of a deep dive into the kind of wines, tell us a little bit about, how you came to be in Sicily. Like, what was the journey from UK to Nigeria to Sicily? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, okay. Well, actually, I was actually brought up in Nigeria. My parents went in the early 50s to Nigeria. So whilst there, we would actually get my first introduction to wine was in Nigeria, funnily enough, because we would go on holidays to Cameroon across the border, which was French territory. My parents used to fill the car with demijohns of wine and then go back to Nigeria. And I mean, they've tried to force me to drink it, but it was actually, I think even my palate then, I realised it was actually, it obviously oxidised, it had been in temperatures of, sort of 40 degrees, so it was really awful. But my parents, they carried on drinking it. Then we would have holidays, it was hilarious. But then we'd go on holidays when my parents came back from Nigeria on leave during the summer. We'd go on holidays to Italy. They had a place in Ibiza. My mother used to drink, I remember Asti Spumante, and it was just, awful. And then I was sent to boarding school when I was 9, but my parents had a house in Suffolk. So after having left school, I moved to Suffolk. And that was at the end of the 70s when they had the wine bar boom. And I remember I used to go to this wine bar called the Butts or the Corkscrew or something. And the only wine you could get was this German, like Blue Nun. And that too was undrinkable. It was awful. So I would be drinking beer. But then next step with my wine sort of education, as it were, I had a close friend, Barbara, who was going out with this guy, a hotelier, who had a lovely country house hotel. And she couldn't drive. So she would ask me to take her to the hotel in the evenings where she would be invited for dinner. I would get invited in to have an aperitivo, which I was introduced then to Sancerre, which I fell in love with. And then Ian Hatfield, who owned the hotel, would then invite me to stay for dinner. And Barbara, my friend, was kicking me under the table to go. And I thought, no way, I'm going to stay. So then I was introduced to a lot of the classic Burgundy wines. So I was drinking things like Chateau Margaux, Lafite, Latour, amazing wines. So this was my sort of introduction to it, thanks to Barbara and thanks to Ian. And then, as I said, my parents had a house in Ibiza, and then holidaying in Ibiza, where, of course, then we were drinking lots of Rioja and lots of Spanish wines, I met some people from Sicily, came to visit in Sicily, came a few times, and then just Sicily, have you been?
I have, yes.
You have?
I love it.
It's terribly seductive. It really is dangerously seductive. And so I ended up staying. Yes, I followed my heart, not my head, and came. So first visit was at the end of the 80s, and then I was here in 91, early 90s, and then a little bit down the line, I then met Ciro. Yes, because the awful thing about Sicily is that I used to come back from England with all this energy, with all these, you know, innovative projects I wanted to do, like children's playgrounds, you know, trying to improve, you know, like getting people to advertise. You know, now you see lots of advertising roundabouts to improve that. You know, I'd go to the comune and they say, no, non si può, non si può. So I was very frustrated. And then finally, it was great. So when I actually met Ciro, I was able to channel all this energy I had into this project, which was fantastic. But it was, you know, a bit challenging initially coming to Sicily. But having spent many years in Nigeria, I think that did help, you know, sort of going with the flow, carrying a book in my handbag all the time. And yes.
So obviously you work very closely with your husband in the winery. I wanted to ask a little bit about, like, working one-on-one with your partner. I know must be, I imagine this must be quite a challenge. Do you divide the roles equally, or are you just accepting the inevitable arguments and going with the flow?
Well, our roles, they're fairly well defined. We've got Manfredi, Ciro's nephew, his sister's son, who works in the cellar. So he takes care of the cellar during the harvest and things. Ciro takes care of a lot of the fatture, the invoices and things. I tend to concentrate a little bit on the incoming, you know, the clients, the visitors who want to come. So the you know, we are fairly, I mean, like when it comes to bottling and the blending, we all sit down tasting together. So it's a little bit, you know, they're fairly well defined. But this, as you well know, is pretty male dominated sort of society here, particularly in Sicily. And I do sort of, Ciro does make the final decisions. I make lots of suggestions, but it's his at the end of the day, his decision, which I, you know, I'm having this responsibility. I don't think I'd want, so I'm rather happy for him to make a lot of the decisions. I mean, we do, me and Manfredi, we do sort of make lots of suggestions and things. But at the end of the day, it's... I think Ciro makes the decisions, yeah. Because as I said, it's this, you know, fairly male dominated. The women, I mean, women are very tough here. They really are. Because not only do they have the traditional roles of like mother looking after the house, but they also work as well. So they really are. And they remind me a lot, actually. Have you read Angela's Ashes by Frank McCourt?
Yes.
Of course. Now, those Irish ladies that would go down to sort of like queue for mattresses, for clothes, and the men would be sort of sticking at home. That reminds me very much of that, the Sicilian women. They are very, very, yes.
Very resilient.
Yes, indeed. Yes, yes. So, so you can say that our roles are fairly defined-ish, yes.
I like the defined-ish. Very diplomatic. So I want to return to you. You mentioned sort of early on in your wine journey, having been able to taste some of the great wines from Burgundy. And I know this has become a bit of a fascination for you and a little bit adopted in your processing methods. So how do you find this combination of Burgundian methods maybe with the indigenous vines and terroir of Etna? How did you put these two things together?
Well, it was actually inspired by a visit to Burgundy, because we were fortunate enough to Robert Camuto, who you probably know, who wrote a book called Palmento. He came a few years ago and became firm friends with. One evening we were having dinner in the vineyard and he came with Albert de Villain and Kermit Lynch. So as a result of this, Albert invited us to go to Burgundy to visit him and the cellar, the vineyards, which was absolutely magnificent. This was in 2011, in February. And having tasted his, we tasted the Grand de Chazot, Saint Vivant, and Montrachet. And that was the 2001. And we just looked at each other and thought, my God, this is amazing. Then we were very reluctant to sort of ask, you know, sort of for any sort of advice or what we should do. We just sort of listened to, you know, we were just in awe, really. So, but then Kermit invited us to, well, he'd actually arranged for us to visit other winemakers, small winemakers. So we felt more comfortable and able to ask, you know, about the winemaking process and what to do and so forth. And so it's like Pour Fousset, there was a wonderful Robert Denogeon. We visited him. Him and his son were there, fantastic. And we spent ages there. And then when we came back, Chira said, come on, let's try and make a little bit of our Montrachet de l'Etna. So we decided to start, this was in 2011, so the first vintage. So what we did, instead of planting lots of Chardonnay, we thought, you know, we'd copy the concept, not the form. And so we decided to have a few experiment and see what came out. So we did, just following their suggestions. So we would do like having picked the grapes, we left them on their skins for 24 hours, low temperature. At that time, it was very difficult because we didn't have a refrigeration unit. So we were using bottles of cold frozen water lowering into the grapes to try and keep the temperature down. Very Heath Robinson sort of style. And then taking the wine into town where the cellar is and then starting the fermentation in oak. The first 3 years wasn't that great, a little bit oxidized because of the transportation. And then from the 2015, we got a little bit happy. Then there was the batonnage, how we were doing batonnage once a week. The 2014, we said, well, let's do it every, you know, once every 2 weeks. So we're still at this experimental stage. But the results, we're really quite sort of pleased with. And, you know, over the years, we've managed to sort of slightly improve. The only concern that we now is we're afraid of it evolving too quickly with the batonnage, which I believe in Burgundy as well, they too are finding this. So, you know, it's still work in progress, but this was, as I said, the inspiration behind it and just using the same, you know, same grape varieties, but we use it from the top of the vineyard Chianta. And this is the name of the cru, the single vineyard Chianta that we make with with this method, because the Utis white, the other white we do, is just very easy peasy, just fermenting the juice in stainless steel. So two totally different styles of wine. And we usually serve this when we do a tasting. We usually serve the Chianta at the end. And it's wonderful to see everybody's faces as they put their nose into the glass. They say, wow, you know, what's this? So it's a very interesting, you know, style that we've introduced. As I said, inspired by that wonderful visit. Thanks to Robert.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting to hear. And particularly with the white wine taking this approach, because colleagues of mine who do a lot of blind tasting have often said that when you taste the red wines of Etna against the red wines of Burgundy, that lots of people can get confused. So it's really interesting to see you taking this on, particularly with the white wines. I think that's a really great and exciting project for the winery.
Yes, because the wines we make are actually to suit our palate, what we enjoy. And we are actually helped by, initially I had a consultant that helped us, but the important person, I think, who put us in the right direction, who shared our same sort of like this type of style, is Cristiano Garella. I don't know if you know Cristiano. He was a young lad. He started working with Sella, Cantina Sella, and he's in Alto Piemonte. He came down, he fell in love with Etna, came down, I think it was 2009 and 10, and he came down, saw some grapes, which we made the wine under his instruction. So he helped us and guided us, like not doing a very long maceration, getting this lovely acidity, this elegance, and the colour slightly lighter, this sort of style, which we enjoy drinking. But it was very difficult at the beginning, you know, talking about this style, is that particularly with Germany, because the German market, you know, when we'd send samples, they said no, because they didn't think it was like Sicilian, because there's such a difference, as you said, between Etna and the rest of Sicily. And initially people just wanted Nero d'Avola. We'd go to Verona for Italy, and everybody say, no, Nero d'Avola, Nero d'Avola. But over the years, people have become, as you said, I mean, Etna has become very, very popular, particularly with people who enjoy the Burgundy style, this nice elegance, acidity, and so forth.
That actually leads really nicely into my next question, which was going to touch on the fact that, you know, the Etna wines, the DOC up in Etna, has begun to receive quite a lot of attention from experts and consumers in recent years. And I wondered what your view on this was and why you think that these wines have suddenly begun to find an appeal in a broader market.
Well, I think purely for this, because these characteristics, and people are very, very surprised when they come and they discover these wines, these high altitude wines. Like Eric Asimov came over because he wanted to explore what was happening on Etna, and mainly for the Calicante, which there's another gentleman who came who actually bought a vineyard here and produces in Sonoma. He thinks that Calicante is going to be one of the best white varietals in the world. You know, this guy, Kevin Harvey. So he's become, fell in love with Calicante. And it's similar because we get these visitors, and we've had people from Santorini. We've compared this, with the Assertico, the Calicante. It's got the same similar characteristics. And it's lovely, this age-worthiness, because people think a white wine can't. But the Utis White, for example, tasting 2014, going further and further back. And, when it's just bottled, you've got this lovely, crispy, crunchy, lemony, this citrusy, this salty, and which then evolves and becomes sort of slightly honeyed. It becomes, lots of layers, a little bit more sort of aromatic. So I think, there is a lot of people recognise this Calicante as being one of the leading varietals it could be in the world. Yes.
You're making me desperately want a glass.
I know, I'm dribbling as I'm salivating, describing it.
It's almost lunchtime as we're doing this, and I'm just imagining a beautiful glass of Calicante.
Yeah. And also we've got, as I mentioned, we've got the Calicante Minella and also the Cataratto, and it's about probably 90% of the Calicante, but we've got quite a lot of Minella in the vineyard as well. Because I think Benanti once, they did a Minella in Purezzo, which they stopped. But one thing I must say about Etna, when we started, there was this real sense of solidarity, this real sense of sort of camaraderie, and we'd often meet together and sort of have dinner here at the vineyards, and it was lovely. It really was the sense of family, because when we started in 1999, there's probably about 9 other producers on Etna who were bottling, and then now, if you think, it'd be about 160 producers now on Etna. So it really has become, which is great, because a lot of the vineyards had been abandoned, so you've got people coming in, buying up the vineyards, replanting. So there's been like a renaissance, I think, as Andrea Franchetti referred to it as, the renaissance, and also Mark de Grazia, who came and I think flew the flag, and sort of with all their marketing teams helped, get focus on Etna, thanks to them as well. And also Benanti, who's one of the pioneers, as you know, and there's, Marco Nicolosi, Villa, Villagrande. There's, lots of people to thank for this. The most important thing, though, is what we try to do is maintain the quality. That's the importance. And so this is something that, we're trying to continue.
It's been really nice to see the sort of gradual regeneration of the area around Etna. Because as you say, when I first visited, there were still quite a lot of vineyards just completely abandoned. And now you've got such fantastic terroir and such a wonderful microclimate. And also on Etna itself, you have microclimates. Obviously, the north and the south faces are very different, which I think is, for me, one of the things that makes the Etna wines so fascinating, and why I think, as you say, one of the things you're doing is doing these kind of single vineyard bottlings. I think this is a really great direction for producers on Etna, because it is so specific and does mirror the wines of Burgundy and also Barolo, in the sense of having these very particular microclimates and terroir that really are incredibly well reflected in the wines.
Yes, because there's also, when you mentioned about the north and the south, initially people were talking about Etna as a whole, and then having divided up now into the contradas, you've got the north and the south. And then it was interesting because everybody said, well, north is best, south. And then when Angelo Gaia bought vineyards in the south of Etna, everybody said, oh, the south mustn't be that bad after all if Angelo Gaia comes and... Yeah. And yes, it's interesting, as you say. I mean, it's so diverse, even here on the south side. And we've got an eruption from 125 BC, which the lava flow, the crater is where the vineyards are built on, the spent crater. But the lava flow goes down to Fabio Costantino. He's got a vineyard, Via Grande. So he's actually, vineyards are planted on our... The lava from our eruptions, as it were, and there's a thread. You can see that there's a similarity, but as you say quite rightly, I mean, it really is so diverse. Hence, we're not in competition with each other. They really are from vineyard to vineyard. Cisano Fori and San Nicolò are two separate eruptions, and the vine, where you taste the wine side by side. Some people say, well, is the vinification different? Is the grapes different? But it's just as you say, because of the terroir, it's just the soil.
I often wonder if this is also where this sense of community that you talk about comes from. Because like you say, you're not in competition with each other. You're just showing what each of the different plots can do. And I really got a sense of the kind of community spirit of winemakers. And every winery I visit, they, you know, they would say, oh, have you been to this winery? Have you seen what these guys are doing? They would just wanted to share the whole of Etna.
Yes, it's an amazing collaboration, you know, particularly amongst the, you know, the early producers. And we would send people, as you say, we'd ring up and I'd ring, you know, Giuseppe Russo, we'd ring Alberto, we'd ring Alicia Bonacorsi, various people, you know, say, oh, yes, we've got some people here. No, great, great. Yes, it's fantastic. Yes, I love it.
So thinking about the future, obviously it's been quite a challenging couple of years for everyone, but let's look ahead with positivity. And I wondered what you think the future is for maybe Etna, but also particularly for what you're doing. You said at the top we were talking that you've just started planting some new vines. So tell us a little bit about what's happening for you in the next few years.
Well, we've purchased another little bit of San Nicolò. So the production of San Nicolò, which is a very, very popular, it's one of the most popular crus, and which is actually usually sold out before it's even bottled. You know, we have to allocate it. So we're going to be able to increase that production. Then I think we're not going to be, we're purchasing another little piece of land, but I think we want to increase the production to about 30,000 bottles, and that's it. Because we've got me, Chira, as I said, and Manfredi. Our son, Alex, is actually in Toronto working within the wine business, doing these sort of hospitality and so forth. But he actually came back just before COVID with the idea to help us with the incoming and with the visitors. But then obviously that all fell, that stopped. So he's actually gone back to Toronto. But this is the thing, when you talk about the future of Sicily as well, I was in New York once and there was an Italian chap there, we were doing a tasting, and he said, there's so many people leaving Italy to go abroad. You know, who is left in Italy to take, you know, the country forward? Because all the brilliant people are leaving. And I actually teach English, and a lot of the parents are investing a lot in their children in order for them to go abroad to further their education. And hopefully they will actually, you know, come back, because this is a problem. But you know, with the government and all the problems at the moment. But as we mentioned earlier, that Sicilians are very resilient. We live on a volcano. We have tremors, but, you know, at the end of the day, that they are very, you know, resilient, and they do manage to overcome any obstacles, any problems that are thrown their way. So they've managed to reinvent themselves in wonderful ways during this period. I mean, our sales we sold nothing from March until sort of actually September. As I said, very few visitors. Oh, in the summer, we had a lot of visitors, but then, of course, that went down again. So it's been a difficult time, but I think it can only get better. Yes, things can only get better, can't they?
Well, I really look forward to seeing how the new plot develops and the wines that come out of it. Stephanie, thank you so much for joining me on the Italian Wine Podcast today. Where can our listeners find you and the wines, online or on social media?
Well, we've got the website, levignobiondi.it, and the website, but also we've got social media. Chiro is a great photographer, so he's on Instagram as Chiro Bion, and I'm on Instagram as Steph Biondi. So there's, you know, we're very sort of active, and there's lots of photographs of you know, the vines, the vineyards, wine, food, the dogs, and so they can find us there. Okay.
Stephanie, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. It's wonderful talking to you. Thanks so much. Okay, bye-bye.
Listen to the Italian Wine Podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We're on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Himalaya FM, and more. Don't forget to subscribe and rate the show. If you enjoy listening, please consider donating through italianwinepodcast.com. Any amount helps cover equipment, production, and publication costs. Until next time, cin cin!